Can you remember when you met your wife?
Yes, that's it. I certainly do. This was an occasion. I'll tell you about that. I used to like to ride horses and so on. I did a lot of horse riding, and I did some rodeo riding in years past at some of the local rodeos out there. But I was breaking a colt from the ranch. I guess I was probably about 18 years old. And I rode this mare up to get the mail. And the wind was blowing real hard. I never will forget that. And it blew the schoolhouse door open, and it scared this horse of mine. And we just went around and around. And she came over out to shut the door. She was staying with a family out there by the name of Kelly.
Because she was the teacher?
She was the teacher. And see, she taught school after she got out of high school. She went to college 2 years and then started teaching. You know, they could get a certificate. And she was 3 years older than I was. Then she'd go back. Every year she taught two. Before she came down there, she taught 2 years out of Greeley, and then she taught 1 year in Pagosa Springs, and then she came over here. But one of my cousins and his family lived on a ranch just south of us, and they had a boy going to school. And so they had dances at the schools almost every Saturday night somewhere. The old community get together. And they came out, let's see, this Virginia asked her class if they knew of anybody that would be going to the dance. And my family was probably the only family in the community that had a car. I've driven a car ever since I was 14 years old. My father never learned to drive, and he didn't want to drive. So I did it.
Why did he buy a car then?
He bought it because he thought we needed a car, but it was a thing. And so as I went over to get the mail, she asked if, and they said, well, the Shoziers go. Well, Virginia thought probably the whole family would go, but I had a couple of young friends over there that I used to take the car and pick them up, and I was going to the dance. And so they asked me if she could ride with me, and I said, sure. So she came out and met me there and asked me if she could go with us. And she always said, I asked you for my first date.
Uh-huh. And you were on this horse.
I was on this horse. So when I showed up that night by myself, I guess she was kind of surprised. And all the rest of the boys were out working somewhere, and I was home. My parents didn't go. So we went to the dance together, and I took her down. That's where I started. After that, we started dating each other, and that's where I met her.
And what was your courtship like? What was courtship like in those days?
Oh, you went to the dance, and we did a lot of dancing, and she was a very likable, compassionate type of person. She just was easy to get acquainted with. She loved everybody, and they used to kid me because I was younger. They thought I was younger than she was. I was 3 years younger than she was. And so every Saturday night we went somewhere. So then our next time, one of the Canini boys' daughter called me and said, we went to town every Saturday. And I was driving the car, and they called me and asked me if she could ride into Durango with me, because, you know, there weren't very many cars around back in those days. That was back in the 28, 29. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure. So we picked her up, came to town, and I let her out, and then we picked her up and take her back. And this is, so they called me one night and asked me if I'd like to come up to their house and play cards. Well, she was up there, and we all played cards together. Then came a Halloween night, and a group of us always got together every Halloween night, and we'd go out and do some tricks, maybe turn over some outhouses or something of this nature. And so she went with us. And that was kind of a disaster, because the school board found out that she went with us to do this. One of the school board members, Dad McGuigan, and I knew him real well, he called me up. He really bawled me out. And I said, well, she wanted to go with us, and I couldn't see anything wrong with it, you know. She was just with the group. We had several other girls with us, and the boy. So that's the kind of type of thing at that time we used to do. And then later on in years, why, she'd be gone in the summertime. I had the responsibility of helping my parents, and I stayed with them until we sold the ranch and got rid of the dairy farm. And I moved into Durango, we did. And that was the year that she got a contract here in Durango. And so from then on, why, we went together, we did a lot of things together, we went to dances together, and finally we decided that maybe we ought to get serious about this after a number of years. And so we were, after she graduated from Greeley College, we were married in that summer. And at that time, up to that time, teachers couldn't teach if they were married here. And that year they changed this status, and so after we were married, they let her continue to teach.
Huh. Now, what was the reason for that?
I can't tell you why. But, you know, there was no, it was just a ruling that they had here. Mr. Emory Smiley, I'm sure you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. I knew him real well.
Because
still
he lived up there,
Virginia. And Warren Broman Jr., his nephew, still live in that house.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a rule that E. Smiley had here, and he was he was superintendent here for years, and he was very strict about some of his rulings and his thinking, and I don't know just how it came that they abolished that rule, and because Virginia wasn't sure, we weren't sure she was going to be able to teach, and I was working, and we figured we'd make a go of it, and she got her contract back.
Wow.
And she taught for 37 years here in Durango.
Mm. Huh. Now tell me more about Mr. Smiley, since you lived
pretty
close.
Well, I'll tell you what I can about him. Until teachers would have to teach in the rural schools for a couple of 3 years so he could evaluate him before he would ever hire him, bring him into Durango. And my wife knew that, and she came in and applied. And he was a very stern fellow. He was our representative for a couple of years, I guess, if I remember right. At that time, probably one of the most sincere and objective people that I have ever known about his work with the teachers and the school district here. After people got to know him, he was one of these people. He was not friendly. He if you know what I mean, he was, and they got to really like him. They got Virginia, after she taught us a year or two, and she told me she was scared to death the first time he ever came into her room, and she introduced him to the children. And he laughed and said, "Thank you. They don't all do that." From that time on, but she felt like, as she put it, I felt like he was a human being. But he was really an instigator and a pillar here in this town, and he did a lot of things, and he was great in organizing the consolidation of this district and bringing everybody in Durango. So, and his family and born mother, Mary Roman and Virginia, and I were very close friends until she lost her life in an automobile accident down in Brownsville, Texas. Mm. So that's probably about the most I can tell you about him. But he had a history here of being very strict, and they respected him. The school boards respected him. The teachers respected him, and he was quite a noted fellow.
Hmm. Well, now let's move down on to Jackson Clark. What can you remember from the first time that you met him?
All right, when I first met him, of course I knew Jackson when I first met him when he was just a child. But after I went to work for them, he went to military school at Carlsbad. And when he came home, this was when the service, he went into the service, and he was in the service of time until, I guess, all those years. Hmm.
This would be in the 30s?
This was, just the beginning of the...
Of World War...
Of World War
II?
II. And, because I went to see him, I was, during the early years of the war, and I was working at the store, and I found out that my boss, Mr. Berkheimer, who was a partner in the business at that time, and then he left later, he was one of the son-in-laws, Harry Jackson, his son-in-laws, and his daughters both all worked in the store. And I found out that that Berkheimer had gotten a deferment for me at the store, and I didn't really care for that. So I went to him and told him. I said, "All my friends are gone, and I think I ought to." So I went up to the draft board and volunteered in the next group. There were, I think, 96 of us went out of here on a bus to Alamosa, and we were examined in Pueblo. That's where the induction center was. And as I got through the line, I heard my name called. And go see Dr. So-and-so. And so I did. I found out where I was supposed to go. And this doctor looked at me and he said, "You know, who sent you up here?" And I said, "Dr. Mason. He was a friend of mine. We grew up together." Well, he said, "I hate to tell you this, but," he said, "you know, you have a serious heart problem." Did anybody ever tell you that? And I said, "Well, I had rheumatic fever when I was a child, and I know that I have, I still have this erratic heartbeat." But he said, "Well, we're having to reject you." And he said, "This is not my business," but he said, "I think you ought to go to a clinic, and I'd like to set one up out in California for you." I came back home, and I went back to work, and I said, "No, I can't do that. You know, you can't get any tires, you can't get gasoline." And so I went back to work, and after about a month, I really kind of got down. So I ended up down Love's Clinic in Albuquerque for a month with this. And at that time, you got me pretty well straightened out, and I came back and went to work, and those people were so good to me that all the time I was down there, they paid my salary. They paid part of my expenses for me.
This is Jackson Hardware.
That's the Jackson Hardware, Jackson's father, mother, and Harry Jackson. And so I went back to work, and about that time, young Jackson was coming home from the service, and his father came to me and he said, I want you to bring him into the store here. I didn't own a business or part of it at that time, but I was one of the buyers. I did a lot of buying for the store, and by that time I had become a sort of a general manager of the store. And he said, Jackson's coming home. I want you to take him, and I want you to start him at the bottom. I want him to go through this business so I can eventually put him in the office. And so that's when I really got acquainted with Jackson. Of course, I knew him before he left, but as I say, I was on, before I went to Pueblo, I decided to take a few days off, and I went to El Paso and took some friends with me. As a matter of fact, Virginia and her teacher friend went with me and her brother. And we came back through Carlsbad to see Jackson there at the military school. So when he came home, his mother said to me, I think he needs a vacation, and so we're going to take him on a vacation to, they went out to California. And while they were gone, his father called me one day and left not too many people back in the store. He said, you know, I'm not feeling well today, and I don't think I'll be down to the store. You think you can handle this all right? And I said, oh, I think so. And so they gave me a lot of privileges. As a matter of fact, gave me a combination to the big safe and everything so I could. The next, he came down that afternoon and he said, well, I think I'm feeling a little better. And he said, I'll be down tomorrow morning. Well, Sam Gilchrist, a friend of mine, was lived next door to him, who owned the Gilchrist store here in town, called me at 7 o'clock that next morning, and he said, Barney, I think I better call you and tell you. But he said Fred Clark was found dead this morning in his bed. And I thought to myself, you guys, what am I going to do now?
Yeah, at least you had the combination to
Well, I did, and I went down and opened up the store, and I thought, I've got to find Marguerite. So I put in a long-distance call to the Berkheimers. They were living out in California at the time. And they said, she's just driving out of the driveway. And I said, can I get a hold of her? And the daughter was here, Tonya. They had taken her over to the neighbors. And I said, Marguerite, I hate to tell you this, but I said, you don't know it, but your husband Fred was found dead in bed this morning. What do I do with this store? And she said, well, we'll be on the way home. We'll be in tomorrow morning. We'll drive all night. Can you hold the fort down till keep things going? So I did. And of course, came back and she put Jackson in the office as quickly as she could, and everything went along, and that's when they offered me an opportunity to buy a little interest in the store, which I did. So we worked together for about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, but Jackson was never really crazy about the hardware business, and she came to me one day and said, "What do you think we ought to do?" And I said, "Well, Marguerite, I don't know, but I think we ought to sell it, get rid of it." And that's when he went into this other business. Jackson went into after we sold the store, and I went to work for the Zurich Hardware Company. And he went over with Dave McGraw, who at that time owned the Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company, and he bought into that. And that's when he got started in this Indian business. You know, I don't know if you've heard the story or not.
Yeah,
you probably
like
have.
How did the Jackson store get its name? Because
his
father's name was
Harry Jackson.
Oh, okay. Harry.
That was the grandfather.
Grandfather was Harry. So Jackson was named after his grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And then this is young Jackson down here now. But anyway, we...
tell me, how did Jackson make that transition into buying and selling
the Navajo stuff?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you about that, and I hope I get it right.
Uh-huh.
His parents were real interested in the Navajo Reservation, and they used to go out there over weekends and just camp out there. And just so when Jackson went into this business, and this is a story that I knew myself, and I knew his. Dave McGraw had a lot of delinquent people owed him for pop out on the Navajo Reservation. And he said, "Jackson, I'd like to send you out there and see if we can collect some of this." So when Jackson Clark went out, he found out that a lot of these people didn't have any cash money, but they had a lot of good Indian blankets. So he came home with a pickup load of Indian blankets. And I guess Dave McGraw, his partner, just threw a fit. He said, "Oh my God, what are we going to do with those?" He said, "You know, I don't think we can handle this." And Jackson stuck with it, and that's how that business got started.
Hmm.
They sold the blankets, cleared up a lot of the debts that those people owed him down there, and he continued in that business, and he became a very authority on weaving and Navajo blankets, as you will probably know. But that's how that got started. He started it. He set up a little shop right there in the where the Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company was.
Hmm. And how popular were Navajo weavings in those days?
Well, they were real real popular. They weren't expensive as they are today. But apparently he didn't have any trouble getting rid of them. He went out different places and sold them, I guess, to different stores and things like that. Anyway, it worked out, and he and Dave just really got into that whole business.
Wow. Now tell me more. Then you got into your next phase of life, which was working for the Zork Hardware Company.
I
tell
traveled
us about that.
That for 10 years. I was on the road most of the time. I was gone probably, I was always gone at least a week or maybe 2 weeks at a time in my main office. I had to go into Albuquerque every so often for sales meetings. We had training schools. This is where I went to a lot of schools to learn public relations and stuff like that, and it was very, very interesting, and it has stuck with me the rest of my life, and I think that's where I get some of my but I'd leave here in the morning, drive to Alamosa, and then I'd be over there all week, the valley in the northern part of New Mexico, up to Blanding, and then I would travel down 3 or 4 days on the Navajo Reservation. I usually stayed in Shiprock. And it was really quite an experience something I really enjoyed and something that I will never forget. Then I got into, I had cataract surgery when I was 55 years old. So I had to, I decided I wanted to quit traveling. And I just had to resign from my job there. Yeah, that's when I went to work after length of time that I, after I had my cataract surgery. And this was quite an experience. If you'd like to hear a little bit about my cataract surgery.
Sure. Let me turn, well, I guess we're doing all right, but I'd like to hear more first about your experiences when you were traveling. Like, what were the roads like?
Oh, the roads were...
Going to Alamos.
Oh, that was... part of the road wasn't even paved there back in those days. You know, it was a hard trip. And but they were working on it. The roads were not good. And the roads I had to travel out on the Navajo Reservation were really rough. Lots of sheep and goats on the road.
Huh.
It was quite an experience. I used to stay at Shiprock, and then I went out and called on the trading post from there. We did a lot of business out there with those people.
And what did a typical trading post look like?
Well, typical trading post was, they traded a lot in Navajo, took jewelry in on pawn. Those vaults were full of pawn. That's where I got a lot of the pawn that we have here now. We sold such things as utensils, enamel, cooking ware, this type of thing. We used to ship some of that in with a carload. Hmm. And most of our business there were that was that type of thing. And I can remember the traders. We always got our cash money from the traders from dealing with them, but I guess mostly was hammers and nails, just the general run of stuff. They would, the Navajos, you know, they didn't have, they lived out on the little tents and
hogans
mm-hmm. at that time. But the roads were bad. Roads were real bad, and I used to have to have my front end adjusted every so often on my car because I shook them out enough. And I built up a lot of friends out there, people that owned those trading posts, because all of them at that time, except one that I traded with in Shiprock, was owned and operated by white people, you know.
And what did their relations seem to be with the Navajo people?
Oh, they all spoke in Navajo.
Uh-huh.
And they did everything. In those days, they did the income tax for those people. You know, they were all on received a sort of a pension and so on. And the trader was handling all that stuff for those people.
Hmm.
And they cashed their checks for them. And a lot of times I would pick up these checks and take them into the Gallup Bank for them. I didn't like to do that, but I did it. And because they needed to get them in there to deposit them.
Hmm. What about the traders' families? Would they live out there?
Yeah, they lived, usually the family that was a manager had a family home right next door.
What would they do for schooling?
That was something, a lot of them never went to school.
Hmm.
But in Shiprock, they had a school. Well, they were beginning to build up the schools at that time, different areas, but you know, they just didn't get a lot of the school. But that has changed a lot out there now. Mm-hmm. They all are.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about the trading post families, though.
Yeah.
That's who you're talking about?
Well, usually those people, either had a family that lived in Farmington or Gallup or somewhere, and these it was a temporary home out there for them, so to speak, and so their families were living in Gallup and so on, so they could go to school. That's about the way it was.
I think I better turn this over, move to a new tape now.